You say you are morally obligated to do remarkable things.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, I think partly because life is so difficult and challenging that unless you give it everything you have, the chances are very high that it will embitter you, and then you'll be a force for darkness and not good. And so, you know, the fact that life is short and can be brutal can terrify you into hiding and avoiding. You can flip that on its head and understand that since you're all in anyways, you might as well take the risks that are adventurous. There isn't anything more adventurous than the truth. So why is that a moral obligation? Well, if you hide and you don't let what's inside of you out and you don't bring into the world what you could bring and you become cynical and bitter, you will start doing very dark things. Not only will you not add to the world what you could add, but you'll start being jealous of people who are competent and doing well and work to destroy them. So that's the pathway to hell. Really. We need to separate out the distinction between fantasy and delusion. You do have a fantasy about the future, so you have to provisionally map the future. That's what a plan is. That doesn't make it a delusion. Like, it becomes a delusion when the map bears no relationship to the underlying territory. So if you have a strategy for the future, you know, maybe let's say that your strategy for the future is that you have 5 million YouTube subscribers in 3 years. Well, you have no evidence of the strict sort that that's how it's going to be, because anything could happen between now and 3 years from now, let's say. But there's no reason to call that a delusion. It's one hypothetically possible path of potential. And then you can make the sacrifices necessary to bring that about. So even though it's a fantasy, because it maps something that isn't there, it's not a delusion. It's a delusion when you're ignoring elements of your own experience that would inform your fantasy more effectively. You're ignoring them so that you can live in a positive representation of the future without having to pay the appropriate price for it. The ultimate ideal is also the ultimate judge, because the ultimate ideal is something against which you fall far short. And that might be so painful that you can barely stand it. But then what you do is you, two things, I suppose, is you lower the ideal and you raise your estimation of your potential. And what do I mean by lower the ideal? Well, if you're comparing yourself to someone or even to a future self and the gap is so painful that it paralyzes you, then you've created a dragon that you don't have the tools to master. And so what you have to do is you have to scale the dragon down to size. And you want to scale the dragon down to size until it's a size that you are willing to move toward, however small that is. Now, you know, if you're here and your ideal is here and that gap is unbearable, then you reduce the gap and you reduce the gap. And you're going to have to do that anyways, because you're not going to move from where you are to perfect in one fell swoop, right? There's going to be incremental steps. So you have to fill in that hierarchy of progression with a high enough resolution representation so that you can start to move forward. There's another gospel comment that's very interesting. It's called the Matthew principle. And the Matthew principle is, to those who have everything, more will be given. And from those who have nothing, everything will be taken. Now, it's brutal because it implies that reality works like this. When you're moving up, you go like this, right? And that's pretty nice. That's a lot better than this. But when you're going down, you go like that, right? It's like downhill, downhill, cliff. Okay, so you want to avoid the downhill path. Well, if the uphill path is like this, which is like exponential, let's say, or geometric, then what that means is that it doesn't matter how big the first steps you take uphill are, even if they're trivial, even if they're shameful in their size, because you're so useless. If you're disciplined in that, you'll speed up extraordinarily rapidly. And so that's the good news, you might say, is that you can take very small steps, even ones that might be shameful in their size, and you have to admit that to yourself. But once you get the ball rolling, it doesn't roll in a linear fashion, it rolls in a geometric fashion. And this is a really good thing to know, because it can take the sting out of the realization of your own stupidity. It's like, yeah, you know, everybody has their weak sides, let's say, things they're embarrassed about. When I first started going to the gym, I was like 23, and I think I weighed 135 pounds, and I was 6'1", very, very thin, 27-inch waist, something like that. And I smoked like mad, and I drank too much. Like, I wasn't in good shape. The first attempts forward I took in the gym, I went to this swimsercise class. Jesus, it was me and this like really fat guy, young guy, probably not in any worse shape than me, and like seven old women over 70, and they could outswim me. Like, it was pretty damn humiliating. And so I did a semester of that and got myself in somewhat better shape. And then I started to go to the gym to work out, to lift weights. And that was also rough because, you know, I'd be underneath the bloody bench press trying to lift 75 pounds off the rests. And, you know, some muscle-headed bastard would come over and tell me how to do it. And it's like, yeah, thank you. But, you know, it's embarrassing. And lots of times people won't do things like go to the gym because they're so embarrassed about how they look or what sort of shape they're in. And it's a pain to start at the bottom, but you start at the bottom where you're weak. And if you want to rectify what's weak, you have to accept the fact that you're at the bottom and that the first steps are going to be painful. You know, it took me about 3 years, but I stopped smoking and then I stopped drinking and I gained 40 pounds of muscle in like 3.5 years, something like that. I basically had to stop doing that because I had to eat like 6 times a day. It was crazy. But I got a lot more physically confident and a lot more coordinated. But the point of all this is, if you're going to rectify your weaknesses, you have to admit your insufficiency to your own shame. Now, if the gap between you and your ideal is so great that it paralyzes you, you shrink that. Things will beckon to you and call to you, and you'll have intuitions about which pathway to take. And you will, in all likelihood, follow those, because what else do you have? You have these orienting instincts. This is another reason why you don't lie. Because if you lie and you practice lying, you pathologize your instincts. And then your intuitions lead you wrong. And so there's a sin that's laid out in the Gospels. It's the sin against the Holy Ghost. And it's unforgivable. And people have been debating for like 2,000 years about what this particular sin is. But it's something like the pathologization of the instincts that orient you. Like, if you sacrifice your relationship to the truth, you warp your vision. And then you can't see. And then one day it'll be dark and there'll be sharp things in the fog in front of you. And you'll wander right into them because you've pathologized your own vision.
Yeah.
You don't want to lie. Because you program yourself falsely, and then you automatically see what isn't there. And then, of course, the world will slap you in the face continually, and you'll think, oh my God, the world's such a pathological place. When the truth of the matter is that, no, you just keep running into things that you refuse to see. And then you think, well, the world's made of nothing but obstacles. It's like, well, you put the obstacles in your own path, and you did that by developing these complex, self-serving delusions, a story that you tell other people about who you are that isn't true. You're trying to lay out a map that bears no relationship to reality, and you keep wondering why you wander off the path and into a pit. It's like, well, how could it be otherwise? People have commented to me many times about my bravery, and I don't like that. It's not right. I'm afraid of different things than the typical person. Maybe that's a good way of thinking about it. I'm way more afraid of the consequences of saying something that's false or wandering off the appropriate path than I am of whatever consequences might come for saying what I believe and doing what I believe to be the case. I'm way more afraid of that. You know, I've been reading the Gospel of St. Matthew. I'm writing a book at the moment called We Who Wrestle with God. And one of the things Christ says to people continually is to not damage their vision, is to not put, that's the best way of putting it, don't occlude your eye. You can see what's in front of you if you're willing to see it. And if you're willing to see it, many of the terrible obstacles in life, you can just walk around. But if you blind yourself purposefully to follow your own narrow, self-serving delusion, you're going to run into terrible things and terrible people and the terrible part of your own soul all the time. That's what you should be afraid of. You can't be isolated, alone, without responsibility, and pursuing your hedonistic nonsense and not be insane and miserable. Those are all the same thing, right? And so, you know, it's got to the point, I've said things that have made me somewhat unpopular, like it's very difficult for people to mature until they have a child. You find a huge part of what you are in that relationship. It makes you responsible, makes you grow up. It gives you the opportunity to mentor someone. You have someone around who's more important than you. Well, that's part of being mentally healthy. It's a huge part of it. This enterprise that I've helped put together, Alliance for Responsible Citizenship, we're trying to put forward a model of governance. It's called a subsidiary model. And the idea is that people have multiple social roles that scale. No, there's you. You should take care of yourself, integrate yourself, which means you can conduct yourself properly across the medium to long run. You're self-sustaining. Then you can maybe extend that to your partner and then to your family and then to your local community and then to broader communities as you become more and more competent and able to take on that responsibility. That's the alternative to isolated hedonic slavery. You're slave to your own whims. And it's the alternative to tyranny, because if you take on all that responsibility, you don't have any need for someone to govern you. It's truly the case that your sanity is the concordance between you as an individual and the world. That's the sanity. You're distributed out into the world, and you should be, and that's, you want to be. That's where the adventure is. You want to be solipsistic? The solipsistic porn masturbator. Jesus, it's no wonder you'd be aimless and miserable. Well, God, it's so pathetic. Why am I so unhappy? It's because you think about yourself. Oh, no, you think about the lowest impulses in yourself all the time. That's why you're miserable. People exist in a sacrificial relationship to the world. What does that mean? It seems to mean something like, human beings are aware of their extended self. You know you're going to be around tomorrow and next week and next month and next year and 5 years from now and 10 years from now. Now it's less certain as you go out, but you do have the sense of yourself as something that stretches across the decades. Okay, and so what that means is that you have to conduct yourself in a manner that isn't merely immediate. You have to conduct yourself in a manner that will work across time. Now, how do people do that? They work. Work is a sacrificial gesture. So you work by definition, virtually. Work is the sacrifice of the present for the future. I mean, maybe someone can come up with a better definition of work than that, but I don't think so. It's like you put in time and effort right now, even if it's something not what you'd like to be doing at the moment, you put in time and effort because you believe, what the hell does that mean? You believe it'll pay off. Well, is that a contract with the future? Is it a covenant? Because the relationship that the biblical corpus characterizes human striving is covenantal. It's a bargain. The bargain is you make the right sacrifices and they pay off. That's the bargain. Now, you might say, well, that's just part of the social contract, but the biblical corpus insists that it's deeper than that. It's built into the structure of reality itself. And that if you got the sacrifices right, the future would be paradisal. Well, that's a kind of sacrifice right there, is that you're willing to sacrifice your short-term physiological and psychological comfort for a medium to long-term benefit. It's the essence of sacrifice. This is something the atheists don't understand about the biblical narrative, is that the narrative insists that we live in a sacrificial relationship. It's the essence of humanity to live in a sacrificial relationship. It's like, well, is that true or not? Well, as you mature, your relationships are more sacrificial. It's less about what you, in your narrow sense, want right now, and it's more about what's good over the medium to long run, including other people. Well, that's a sacrificial relationship. Now, the covenant, you know, and this is a matter of faith. It's the matter of the deepest faith. Are you willing to act out the proposition that the way to make the world reveal itself to you in its most positive guise is for you to adopt the most appropriate sacrificial relationship? Well, it's a big risk, isn't it? Because you have to give up everything. That's the deal. You give up everything that's low. Everything. Everything. Well, that's what the Christian passion is, because the Christian passion is an archetypal story, because Christ is the person who sacrifices everything thoroughly, 100%. There's no indecision because you age. Like, you pay for your indecision. It's a decision. It's a decision to avoid, fundamentally. No, and part of the moral that's embedded in the story of Job and in the Christian passion is that you can master what you'll face. And maybe that's true. I mean, the clinical literature seems to indicate that it's true, because one of the things you do, if you're a competent clinician, is you look at what people are attempting to accomplish, and maybe that needs some retooling, but let's assume that they have a goal in mind that would work, right? You've talked it through with them strategically. They have a well laid out vision. Okay, now they're laying out the vision and they encounter impediments that stop them. And maybe they're impediments that make them afraid and paralyze them. And so then what you do is you decompose the impediment until you find a way they can advance that constitutes a genuine advance that they'll actually do. So what you do is you take the problem and you narrow it until they'll face it. Okay, then they face it. Then what happens? They get more competent. That's what happens. And then they get better at facing all problems. So they don't just learn how to deal with that specific problem. They learn a lesson that generalizes across problems. They get braver. When you use exposure therapy, people don't get less afraid. They get braver. And that's way better. Because braver moves from situation to situation. Okay, so the question is, if you faced everything that was put in front of you, who would you be? Well, the answer, the biblical answer is you'd be a true son of God. That's the biblical answer. It's like, well, do you believe that? Well, it depends on what you mean by believe. Do you have a better bet than facing what's there? Well, you just have to be sensible about it for a moment. It's like, is your theory that you're going to adapt better using falsehood and avoidance? Because that's the contrary theory. You either face it, and you do that predicated on the faith that something in you will respond if you do, or you don't face it. That's it. Those are the options. If you don't face it, that's faith too. That's faith in the notion that avoidance and deception will suffice. There's technically two different forms of reward. There's consummatory reward. That's what an orgasm is. It's consummatory reward. It brings the behavioral and perceptual sequence to a halt. It ends it, right? At the climax, it ends it. But then it's over. That journey is over, right? Then there's the dopaminergic reward. And dopaminergic reward is evidence of advancement towards a goal, right? Okay, so there's a corollary to that. Well, how do you become optimally engaged? Because dopamine facilitates engagement and focus, which is why drugs like amphetamines can be used for kids who are attention deficit disordered. You tap up the dopamine response, they lock on, right? Okay, so they're locking on to a goal-directed pursuit. The problem with amphetamines is that they can lock you on so hard you can't get out of the frame. So like kids on amphetamines will obsess, for example, about cleaning up their closet. They can't switch to the next activity. Okay, dopaminergic reward is reward that's accrued in relationship to a goal. Okay, so what's an implication of that? Well, pursue the highest possible goal. Well, why? Because the kick from advancement is higher. Now, you have to balance that. It can't be, you have to advance, right? Because imagine the reward's got two components. Number one is you're moving towards something valuable. Okay, so you want it to be as valuable as possible. Okay, but you have to be moving. You need something extremely valuable that you can move towards. Okay, so part of the reason that you establish a relationship with God, let's say, is because that's what sets the upper bound to your vision. It's like, I want things to be the best they could be. That's a vision of paradise. Well, that has to be fractionated into, you know, your proximal decisions, but lurking behind that should be this continual movement towards, what would you say, a heaven that recedes as you approach it. That's the proper vision of heaven. A heaven is a place that's perfect and getting better, both at the same time. That's what music shows you, because a great piece of music is perfect, but it's just getting better as it unfolds. And you need that. This is part of the problem with a static utopian vision, something Dostoevsky criticized. If you gave people nothing but consummatory reward, he famously says, so that they can do nothing but sit in tubs of hot water, eat cake, and busy themselves with the continuation of the species, human beings would break that all to hell in a moment just so they have something interesting to do. If you run yourself through a disciplinary process, so you accomplish something, maybe you don't attain the goal you were aiming at, but you accrue a new way of looking at the world and a set of skills. Well, if you just keep doing that, you have multiple ways of looking at the world and more skill. Well, that's your storehouse of treasure. As you walk through life in your normal mode, things will call to you. And if you pursue them, they will take you deep. It doesn't really matter what it is that calls. What matters is that you pursue it and you pursue it to the depths. And as you pursue it to the depths, you will become transformed. And if you do that without reservation, that will turn you into the person who frees the slaves and opposes the tyrants. And that is how it works. That's the call. And that can happen in any direction, virtually any direction. You just have to pursue it with sufficient faith. It's really something to see how many people are dying for a lack of an encouraging word. You know, they don't get encouragement. And people need so little encouragement. Yeah. It's just unbelievable.
You know, I believe that truth will save the world. I believe that. So you speak truthfully and you watch what happens and you take your consequences.
You're a net force for good if you want to be. One of the things you do with people who are struggling is you make the simple even simpler, because then they can get a toehold. You know, like if they're really barely able to move. I had one client, you know, he had a hard life, man. He was like 85. He'd fallen off a ladder and broken his neck, and they had permanently fused it. So he was basically like this. He could hardly move. He was so depressed. He literally couldn't get out of bed. It was awful. And he was in chronic pain because of his broken neck. And so the first thing I did with him was get him to sit up for like 30 seconds. That was it. That's where he had to start, you know. And after I worked with him when he was in the hospital, after 2 weeks, he was walking down the hall and able to sit up and read for, you know, 5 or 6 minutes. And he got out of the hospital. He went home. But he had to start with the simplest possible steps. And hey, man, this is the definition of humility in some ways, is that you start progressing where you can start. Well, one of the really difficult things to learn when you're down and out is how far you're down, because it's humiliating. You know, I was ill recently, and when I started to recover, I couldn't really button my shirts. I had to learn to do that again. I had forgotten how to put my hands on keyboard. I didn't know where to put my hands. I had to learn to type again. Now, I hadn't lost all the knowledge and it came back quite quickly. And the reason I'm saying that is because one of the impediments to people who've really taken a blow in their life is that things have fallen apart around them so badly that where they have to start is humiliating even to consider. The rule, it's a pretty straightforward rule when you want to get back on your feet. And the rule is you have to make the task small enough so that you'll do it, no matter how small that is. I mean, one of the things I've become well known for is my advice to start by cleaning up your room. But I had plenty of clients who they couldn't go home and clean up their room. They hadn't cleaned up their room for like 20 years for all sorts of reasons. Maybe because every time they did try to do anything positive in their family, no matter what it was, they were immediately punished and undermined. And so if they even went home and dared to start cleaning up the room, they'd face resistance within the family that was just a manifestation of the 50,000 times they'd been discouraged in the past, but also a move that would upset the insanity that characterized the pattern of familial interactions. And so actually, if they even made a move to clean up their room, what they were doing simultaneously was confronting the dragon in the family that had made every single person in that household insane for like 5 generations, right? So it looks simple. It's not bloody simple. And so in a situation like that, you cut it down so that maybe the first thing they do is clean up, like maybe they look inside one drawer and see the mess that's there and just look at it for a minute and think about how they might reorganize it if they were going to. When people are very down and out and they decide to make a move forward, in some ways they're facing the whole panoply of problems that confront them in the guise of that single problem, right? It's all lurking behind it, right? It's like, you know, they see the tip of a reptile's tail outside a gigantic closet, let's say, and they look and they think, well, that's just the tip of a tail. What harm can it do me? But it's connected to the whole damn beast. And the advantage to that is that if you make that first step forward, you're actually advancing in the face of all that opposition. The disadvantage is that the first task seems so small that you literally have to be on your knees to be humble enough to lower yourself to take that first step. You know, God, is that all I can do? I'm so useless. You might even be more useless than that because you might fail at it. I had lots of clients who would come back. You know, we'd make a deal that they would do something simple. I remember one client, this is such a comical story in a terrible, dark way. You know, he was an overgrown infant and he was 30. He was still living at home. in his messy, you know, high school room under the thumb of his mother, conveniently for him, because then he never had to do anything. And he had managed to entice some girl into sleeping with him and she got pregnant. Now he's going to have a son. And he had enough sense to come to me and say, you know, I'm kind of a wastrel and I've mucked up my life, but maybe I'd like not to destroy this kid. So is there something I could do to put myself together? So, you know, we talked that through. We negotiated, which is what you do with a client if you're sensible. You know, you lay out the problem first. Okay, what the hell's wrong with you, do you think? You have to listen and listen and listen while the person unfolds everything that might be wrong. They put all their cards on the table and then you sort through them and you think, well, some of that's not really the central issue. And so you imagine they lay all the cards on the table and then you kind of get rid of 90% of them.
It's a symptom.
Yeah. It doesn't really bother me now that I've talked about it. That doesn't seem key. I think I'm really done with that. That isn't interesting to me, but they'll still have to lay it all out. And then you focus on the problem. And then the next thing you think is ask them is something. This is great general problem solving strategy is, okay, if this could be better, as far as you're concerned, what would better look like? And then they have to lay their cards on the table about that. So you do the same thing. And now you have the diagnosis. That's the problem statement. And now you have a hypothetical cure, let's say. And now you need a strategy, right? And that would be the steps in between the problem and the final destination. And then you break down the steps until you find a step that the person will take. And you have to do that experimentally. So the first step for him was to vacuum the carpet in his room. And so this is literally what he did. He brought the vacuum. It was a stand-up vacuum. He brought that into his room, but he only got it to the threshold. And then he left it 45 degrees across the door, leaning, and he walked over it for a whole week. And so then he had to come back and tell me, you know, and he was embarrassed. He said, you know, I got the vacuum cleaner just to the doorway and I left it there. And then instead of bringing it into my bedroom, I just, you know, I put an obstacle in my own path and stepped over it for a whole week. It's a very humiliating thing because he knew that his life was on the line and he knew that his son's life was on the line. And he knew that he was one useless bastard for not being able to bring that vacuum cleaner into the room, you know, but the proper interpretation of that in part is, well, you got the bloody thing out of the closet, didn't you? You know, so what we did was renegotiate. This is called collaborative empiricism. It's a behavioral approach for clinicians. And the collaboration is, well, as I said, what's the problem? Diagnosis. What's the potential solution? The person has to be on board with all this, right? I mean, they have to be the people who decide that's the problem. You can't enforce that on them. They have to discover it for themselves. And the same with the solution. And the same with the strategies. It's like, I don't know what's right for you. I'll listen. We can jointly explore what might be the right vision for you. And then we can break that down into a strategy, but you have to be on board with the strategy. You have to feel that this is right for you. And then we'll say, okay, well, maybe this is a solution. Why don't you go implement it? Come back next week after having attempted this. Let's see how it went. You know, and sometimes people come back and say, well, you know, that went great and it started me and I did three other things. And you know what? We seem to be on the right track. And sometimes they come back and say, nope, that didn't work at all, like with the vacuum cleaner. And so then you have to think what you do in that situation is make the task smaller. If you make the task small enough, I've never seen anyone not be able to progress if they made the task small enough. But, you know, that can be pretty humiliating. Now, the upside is that once you've taken that first step, you've looked the beast in the face and you'll start progressing, not linearly, but exponentially in speed. So what's cool is that it doesn't really matter how small that first step is because it'll start doubling and anything that doubles grows unbelievably quickly. And so that's a very useful thing to know too. And that's true when you're learning anything new. It's like you'll feel like an imposter, you'll feel like a fool because you are, and you'll think I'll never get there. And it might be, the destination might look very distant, but if you take a sufficiently small first step and get the ball rolling, you can be cruising along at a pretty good rate, generally faster than you'll think. What seems to happen when you expose people to small but challenging tasks, it does two things. It makes them more skilled because now they're actually dealing with the problem. And so they're acquiring the new perceptions and the new behaviors that are mastery. So they're actually expanding their domain of conceptual structures and actions. Mm-hmm. That's both conception and skill. But at the same time, they're seeing themselves as the actors that can change the direction of their life.
The modern idea is you're supposed to accept yourself. I think that's an insane idea, by the way. Really, I can't think of a more nihilistic idea than that you're already okay. It's like, no, you're not. And the reason you're not is because you could be way more than you are. And so what do you want to be? You want to be okay as you are? Or do you want to strive towards what's better? Human beings are insufficient in and of themselves and need the movement upward. And so they need to conceptualize something like the highest good and then to strive for that.
You should love and feel good about the person you are now. And that's actually a dubious proposition for a variety of reasons. One is, whatever yourself is not only what you are. Yourself is also what you could become. And so to love yourself properly is not only to love what you are, who you are, whatever that means, but to love who you could become. Now, one of the things I've observed is that it's very demoralizing for the typical young person who's miserable and maladjusted psychologically and socially if you just go to them and say, well, you should feel good about yourself, because they think you're good just the way you are. You're perfect just the way you are. You should accept yourself just the way you are. It's like, well, okay, so what does that say about who I should become? Is that just now off the table because I'm already good enough in every way? So am I done or something? What about who I should become? And then, well, how should I feel good about myself when I don't? Because I'm not getting along with myself. I'm anxious and hopeless and nihilistic and depressed. And I'm not getting along with other people. So how is it that that's all somehow something I should feel good about without being deluded? And these are complicated questions, because you don't want to beat yourself with a stick, which might be the opposite of that. So, well, feel bad about yourself. It's like, no, be judicious and merciful with yourself and think that you need to accept yourself in some way, the way a mother accepts a child. But the maternal spirit is not the only spirit that governs the love that a child requires properly. You have the paternal spirit of encouragement as well, which is, well, we need to shelter and protect you and to provide for your security the way you are, but you could be a lot better and should be. And I have faith that you could be, which is the love that I'm delivering to what you're becoming rather than what you are. And so love that you direct towards yourself is partly directed towards that maternal care that's sort of the minimum precondition for basic flourishing, combined with an attitude of encouragement towards the possibilities of your being. And so that's a much more sophisticated so-called self-love, partly because it's the kind of love that envisions you as something that unfolds across time. And it's a much richer conception, because it also implies that there's a responsible adventure to your life. You're not all you could be, and there's pain in that. And there's the necessity for a certain amount of judgment about that, and even a certain amount of exclusion, because what you are that is insufficient in some sense should be not be allowed to propagate further. But if it's conjoined with encouragement, it's like, yeah, you're in a rough situation there, kiddo, but, you know, here's some things about you that are virtuous and good, and they're pretty powerful, actually, and if you just made those more manifest, you could dispense with a lot of this immaturity and misery, and you could expand yourself out into life physically and psychologically, and you could start walking this pathway that makes things better. And the thing is that as soon as you start walking the pathway that makes things better, then things immediately become better, because your whole orientation changes. And, you know, if you're in a bad place but you're escaping, that's pretty positive, even if it's a bad place. And you might think, well, it's still bad, but it's better. It's like, well, that's a lot better than a bad place that's getting worse. That's for sure, because that's hell. Hell is a bad place that's getting worse. That's for sure. And so if you take the bad place and it's getting better, well, it's already not hell. That's a start. And so this notion of love, we've confused this with the maternal instinct for an infant. It's like, because an infant under 6 months, it's like, well, of course, your attitude towards an infant is you're exactly okay the way you are. But that's not what you do to any child that's older than 6 months. You start laying down some criteria for becoming, for improvement. And some of that improvement, because we can define it, well, there's nothing more perfect than a child.
than a baby. It's like, yeah, but that's not true if the baby's 14 years old, right? It's true if the baby's 6 months old and actually a baby. But by 9 months, well, the child is going to start to interact socially. And now there's some principles that the child has to learn to abide by so that social interaction is optimized. You want to take the infant who's entirely dependent and turn them into something that's autonomous and then socially integrated, and then socially integrated in a manner that's moving them towards individual responsibility. And the love is not only love that's devoted to what they are at any point, which is that encompassing maternal love, say, but the love that says, yeah, kid, you know, we're pretty happy you're around, but the new you is gonna even be better. And that's encouragement, and that's part of love. It's half of love, that's for sure. And you wanna direct that to yourself as well. It's like, you don't wanna judge who you are so harshly that you just destroy yourself and everything is cast into the pit. You want to take a look at yourself and say, look, you know, you're a person among persons and you have intrinsic worth and you have your flaws, your sins, your domain of ignorance and inadequacy, but that doesn't mean that you're entirely worthless because of that. You have a base level value. That's intrinsic worth, let's say, that's reflective of the fact that you're made in the divine image in the most fundamental sense. You have intrinsic worth and that's due a certain degree of baseline love. But there's the becoming problem. It's like, well, especially when you're young, most of you is still in the becoming phase. And so why wouldn't encouragement be the hallmark of love? It's like, get the hell up, get your act together, adopt some responsibility, put your life together, develop a vision, expand yourself beyond the narrow confines that are causing your misery. And we think you can do it. You could do it, you should do it. The world would be better off if you did it. You'd be doing better if you did it. Everything would work out better. Why would we not work to make everything work out better? And you're the person who could do it. And you tell young people that and they think, oh, no one ever told me that before in that way. And they think, well, maybe I should get my act together. And then they go out and try to get their act together. And they think, well, huh, turned out that worked and I'm less miserable. I could try doing it a little bit on a broader scale. And they try that and they think, wow, people seem a lot happier with me. I have more friends and I'm more popular and I'm a little more physically attractive because I'm standing up a little bit straighter. And then away they go and unfold, man. Be a force for good in the world. And that'll be the adventure of your life.
Aimless is not nothing. Aimless is bad. Nietzsche said if you had a why, you could bear any how.
Most people find the meaning in their life through responsibility. I believe the fundamental religious truth of the idea that life is suffering. It's suffering because we're mortal and fragile and because we're also subject to malevolence at our own hands and at the hands of others. It's a constant existential problem. And that can make you bitter and can make you hopeless and nihilistic and depressed and anxious and likely to abuse substances of various sorts as a medication or an escape. It can auger you in a very large number of ways. And I'm suggesting to people that there is a way out of that. And the way out is to confront that forthrightly and to adopt responsibility in your own life and to try to make the world a better place. And that it's necessary to do that. And that if you don't do that, that things go badly.
I think the deck is stacked against everyone to some degree because life is very difficult and we all die. Some people do have it harder than others. And all of us have it very hard at some times in our lives. It's like, well, what's the alternative? You take responsibility for that and try to struggle uphill because the alternative makes everything worse.
Find something in your life that's so worthwhile doing that the fact that you're going to suffer is justifiable.
Yeah, life's rough, no doubt about it. And if good luck comes your way, then you should be grateful for it. And if happiness manages to manifest itself, you should be grateful for that too.
So then you might ask yourself, well, what's the best antidote to the discomfort of life? And you might say, well, it's comfort. And I suppose that's what you act out when you swaddle a baby. But a better antidote is something like adventure to excellence. And that's far better antidote to suffering than the mere absence of suffering. So, not to say that the mere absence of suffering, that's not nothing.
I've been a psychotherapist for 20 years. I've seen things you can't imagine, horror shows that you can't fathom, and people who have been hurt in so many ways, so many dimensions. It's like, should they be bitter? Should they be resentful? Should they become violent? These things don't help. They have to struggle uphill despite their excess burden. And it's responsibility, not guilt.
It's the female crucifixion.
So,
and that's exemplified best in, well, the best portrayal of that I've seen is Michelangelo's Pieta. You know, it's a statue of Mary, and she has Christ's body on her, as an adult, on her lap, and
yep.
he's broken and destroyed, and, you know, she's displaying that. And that's the bravery of a mother to allow that to happen, but not only that, to facilitate it. Facilitate it. Here you go, kid. Where you go? Where you go? Well, why? It's dangerous out there. It's like, yeah, no kidding. It's more dangerous here if you stay with me by a lot. So you might lose your body out there in the world, but if you stay here, you lose your soul.
You know, I mean, it's a pretty competitive world. There's lots of competition for young men in particular. There's competition for status and limited resources and for the attention of women. And just because you're nice doesn't necessarily mean that you come out particularly well in those competitions.
I would like to say that you should all be smarter, but I don't know how you could be smarter. We don't know anything about how to improve intelligence, and I suppose we don't really know anything about how to improve industriousness either, but I can tell you that people who are industrious come up with a strategy for solving the problem that's ahead of them, and then they do whatever they can to stick to the strategy. And so, for example, if you sat down today or tomorrow for a couple of hours, 3 hours, and you filled in a Google Calendar, whatever you happen to use, with a strategy for studying and a list of when all your assignments are due and all of that, and when you're going to sit down and study, then you won't be in a position where you have to cram for 10 hours a day hopelessly right before, you know, an important exam.
It's beautifully put that love is the highest ideal to reach for, and truth is...
It's handmaiden. I thought about that for a long time, right? This hierarchy of ideal. And the thing about truth, that bitter truth, let's say, that cynical truth, is it can break the shackles of naivety. And actually, a burnt cynicism is a moral improvement over a blind naivety, even though one is in some ways positive, but only because it's protected, and the other is bitter and dark, but still better. But you're not done at that point. You're just barely started.
I think optimally we exist to have something like a playful adventure, right? We're built for an optimal challenge. It's partly why we like to play, because in play you find an optimal challenge. It's almost like the definition of play. And so if you can organize yourself and the world optimally, then you have adventure. And maybe you have the adventure of your life. And if you can do that brilliantly, then you can do it in a spirit of play. That's what you need and want.
I saw an endless repetition in my clinical practice and in my own private life when my eyes were open, the consequences of not saying what was true. It's like whatever hell you might fall into by opening your mouth when you have something to say that isn't popular, it's nothing like the hell that you're going to envelop yourself in if you lose control of your own tongue and mind. And I, like I said, in my clinical practice, I never saw anyone get away with anything even once. And so all you have in a situation like that is what is the truth. Now, you know, of course, you only have your approximations to the truth, but that's better than nothing. And so you need to be afraid of the right thing, and you should be afraid of contaminating your soul with deceit. That's what you should be afraid of. What happens is, you know, garbage in, garbage out, the old programmer saying goes, and so you'll fill your head with nonsense and no one will call you on it except you, but you can still that voice if you try hard enough. You just wait until you get in real trouble. You know, one day there'll come a point where you have to make a decision. And the decision is the difference between life and death, or worse, between someone else's life and death, or worse, between health and the suffering that's worse than death. And because you've compromised yourself to such a degree, you will not be able to rely on your judgment, and you will make the mistake you shouldn't make.
and then you're done. And that will absolutely happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, you set what's great against what's tragic.
Yeah.
I mean, what else could you possibly do? And so then you say, well, how do you find what's great in your own life? And part of that is you watch. It's like, when is it that I'm doing something that alleviates my suffering, right? It's a real, you have to ask that question to yourself honestly. One of the things you have them do is say, well, why don't you just watch for a week? Like, watch yourself like you don't know who you are and just see when you're not quite as miserable.
Yeah.
And then let's see if we can figure out what it is about what you're doing in that situation that's lifting the gloom. It's like, okay, there's something in that that's curative, right? And that's something in that that's curative is related to, well, you might say your purpose. It's like maybe part of the reason you're depressed is because you're too isolated. And now we can work on that. So let's see if we can increase the amount of time you're spending with your friends by like 20%. Or maybe you need a couple of new friends. Or maybe you need to work on your comic material, you know, because you can set that against the tragedy of life.
This is, I think, why people are so obsessed in some sense with the search for fundamental meaning. This is a good story. So you can imagine two people laying bricks, they're building a gigantic wall, and the one person thinks, oh my God, you know, this wall is going to take 100,000 bricks. I'm laying one at a time and I'm wasting my life away, trivially adding to this gigantic brick wall, and what am I doing? This is absolutely miserable, brick by brick. And the other person thinks, in 300 years, this is going to be a cathedral. And so the person in the second state is doing exactly the same thing at a local level, laying bricks, but each brick is related to a very high goal. And that means the reward that's attendant upon the laying of the brick is proportional to the goal of the entire behavioral process. So if you're aimless and goalless, then you can't elicit any positive emotion. And if your goals are fragmented, which is also what happens if you're aimless or your goals lack unity, if your goals are fragmented, then no given behavioral manifestation can elicit any dopaminergic reward because it's not a step forward to anything desirable. One of the things, well, I did write about this in my first book, particularly about putting your life, putting your house in perfect order. It's like, well, if you're lost, one of the things you can do is look around and see what direction you could take locally. Fix something. Find something that you could do that would make things better that you would do. And there's a humility in that too, because especially if you're in a low energy state, it's like, oh my God, you know, I don't have enough energy to make dinner. It's like, do you have enough energy to put a fork on the table? And sometimes people are so depressed that that's really all they can do. Can you take a small step forward, no matter how small that is? Implement a micro routine, even something like washing a cup and putting it back in the shelf. And you know that's a good thing because you have a shelf and there's cups on it. You've already decided that's an appropriate way to live, is to have your coffee cups on a shelf. If you go ahead with cleaning out the cup and putting it on the shelf, then you've taken steps towards a valuable micro goal. You get a dopamine kick from that. That transforms itself into adrenaline and energizes you. But in part, what the dopamine system is doing. So imagine that the purpose of the dopamine system is to elicit a satiating reward, fundamentally. But then the satiating reward is something that has to be approached in steps. And so in order to maintain the motivation necessary to approach the satiating reward, you have to mark each of the steps with a marker of pleasure. Small things are not small. You might have the cognitive appraisal that doing something local, like cleaning up your room, is small, but it's not obvious at all that that's the case. It's not that trivial to put your immediate surroundings in order, and it can easily be the stepping stone to putting things in order on a broader scale. In fact, it's probably the necessary stepping stone to do that. You can pat yourself on the back, especially if you're depressed, a little harder than you might otherwise by saying, you know, you say, well, this is trivial, but I did it. It's like, no, if you're moving ahead, that's not small. You just keep doing that, you're going to get out of this paralyzed or retreat mode. If you're in the zone of proximal development, you're pushing your skill development one increment forward. And it's one that you can actually manage. Imagine that you have someone who's habitually avoidant. And maybe they're avoidant because when they become possessed by negative emotion, they become hyper aware of their internal state and they feel the panic. And so then they freeze or retreat. And they do that constantly. And then they're in this terrible negative emotional state all the time, because every time they see a stimulus that's associated with retreat, they get gripped by these interoceptive sensations. And so you say to them, well, we're going to reverse that. Instead of you being gripped by that, you're going to expose yourself to that voluntarily. See, if you do that repeatedly with people, not only do they stop being afraid of the things that you're showing them, that you're exposing them to, but they become more likely to approach other things they're afraid of, far more likely. In fact, it doesn't exactly look like people get less afraid at all. It looks like what happens is they learn to get braver. One of the cognitive phenomena that loads very heavily on neuroticism is self-consciousness. And so when you fall into anxiety, then there is this internal obsessiveness, which has to do with the panoply of sins in some sense. Which parts of me are malfunctioning and need to be eradicated? And one of the things I used to do with my socially anxious clients, so they would go into a social situation, often with eyes downcast, by the way, and they would be so intensely concentrating on their own internal sensations that they would fail to make eye contact with anybody they were talking to. And then they would be awkward because they weren't reading the cues they could have read if they would have only looked. And then the conversation would become disjointed, and then they would get anxious and fall into themselves. And so one of the things that I taught them to do wasn't to try to calm themselves down, but to try to calm the other person down. So when you go into a social situation, pay more attention to the other person. Like, just focus your attention outward. And if the person had any social skill, sometimes I had clients who had no social skills. And so they were anxious socially because they actually didn't know how to behave socially. So then you had to teach them the social skills. But some of them had the skills but wouldn't activate them because they were so neurotically obsessed with their own inadequacy that they failed to attend to the cues that would elicit the proper responses. And all they had to learn to do was watch. And then they would automatically respond because they knew how to have a conversation. See, the reason that socially anxious people are so interoceptive is it's involuntary, right? They get gripped by the negative emotion, and then that produces this intense, obsessive interoception. That might not happen if they did it voluntarily. This is why exposure therapy works so well in psychotherapy. Is like, well, I'm afraid of something, and if I go near it, then I'm possessed by negative emotion. Well, that's if you go near it accidentally. I'm going to have you go near it purposefully. And what you're going to find is that to the degree that you do it purposefully, that response will be quelled. And that happens. It's extraordinarily reliable. Imagine you anticipate something and then you make a mistake. Now, the question then becomes, how significant is the mistake? The depressive takes that punishment response, let's say, that's a consequence of failed anticipation and can't bind it. It just takes out all of their potential future selves. And so then they're in a depressive pit. That's too much learning from failure. That binding problem is really tricky. One of the rules of thumb for that that's extremely useful, that's socially instantiated, is innocent until proven guilty. So you might say, when those thoughts come up, because they're adversarial and accusatory thoughts, you might say, well, that is part of the realm of possibility. But when your child does something wrong that's minor, you don't say you're a rotten kid. You bind it. You say, look, kid, here's a bunch of things you're doing right. But in this particular example, specific situation, here's the minimal thing you did incorrectly and how to alter it. And it's a really good habit of mind to address towards yourself as well as to other people, which is to say, well, what's the minimum crime that I'm responsible for in this moment? And that's part of this miracle of the presumption of innocence, and especially without proof. A lot of what I did in my clinical practice to people who had a depressive temperament was help them make a case for themselves. It's like, well, maybe you're as bad as you think you might be, but maybe not. Let's take the contrary argument.
and only narrow the repair to the absolute minimum that needs to be manifested. Sometimes when you make one little mistake, it is actually an indicator of a flaw in your character. But most of the time it isn't. And it certainly can't be responded to that all the time, because then you'd never be able to make a mistake without wiping yourself completely out. You want to make it as local and precise as you possibly can. And that's also one of the advantages to removing yourself from a rage or an anxiety state, because a rage or an anxiety state is low resolution and global. And so it'll be globally accusatory. So you want to specify it and you think, okay, well, what's the minimum necessary behavioral transformation to ensure that similar mistakes are not replicated in the future? It's like if your roof leaks, you don't have to dig a new foundation. You can just fix a few shingles. And you might think, well, the rain's coming through, so you have to tear down the whole house. It's like, well, no. And you might panic and run around because the water's coming in, but it's still a bad idea to dig up the foundations every time something trivial, maintenance problem, needs to emerge. And so one of the things that's very useful to learn is like, well, is this only a trivial maintenance problem? And one of the advantages to that too is that if it's not the collapse of your entire self, let's say, and it's a trivial maintenance problem, you're much more able to activate that courageous response to anomaly that's part and parcel of exploratory behavior and eventual success. So, and part of the trick of many sorts of, well, I would say religious training enterprises, certainly the meditative enterprises, is something like, how do you tell yourself a story, like a real story, though a story that actually works, where you can confidently approach the thing that's blocking your path?
I've been trying to figure out what gives people's lives meaning. And if you look at it technically, in order to have any positive meaning in your life, you have to have identified a goal. And you have to be working towards it. And there is a technical reason for that. And the technical reason, as far as I can tell, is that the circuitry that produces the kind of positive emotion that people really like is only activated when you're proceeding towards a goal that you value. And so that means that if you don't have a goal that you value, you can't have any positive emotion. So technically, that's the incentive reward system. And it's the underlying circuitry is dopaminergic. And when that circuitry is activated, then it's part of the exploratory circuit. It gives you the sense of being actively engaged in something worthwhile. You know, you tend to think of positive emotion as something produced by reward. But there's two kinds of positive emotion. One is the reward that's associated with satiation, and that's consummatory reward, and that's the reward you get when you're hungry and you eat. But the thing about eating when you're hungry is that it destroys the framework within which you were operating, right? It's time to eat. Well, you eat, and then that framework's no longer relevant. So the consummatory reward eliminates the value framework, and then you're stuck with, well, what are you going to do next? And so the consummatory reward has with it its own problems, but the incentive reward is constantly what keeps you moving forward. And incentive reward, because it's dopaminergic, also is analgesic, literally analgesic. So if you're in pain, you take opiates and that will cut the pain, but so will psychomotor stimulants like cocaine or amphetamines. And so it's literally the case that if you're engaged in something that's engaging and you're working towards a goal, that you're going to feel less pain. And you can see this happening with athletes who, you know, they'll break their thumb or something, or maybe sometimes even their ankle, and they'll keep playing the game. Of course, afterwards, they're suffering like mad, but the fact that they're so filled with goal-directed enthusiasm means that, well, the pain systems are in some sense shut off. So that's an interesting thing, because what it suggests, I mean, then you could imagine, I might say, well, how happy are you that you've made a certain amount of progress? And if you think about it, what you'd say is, well, it depends on how much progress and in relationship to what. So hypothetically, you're going to be happier if you've made quite a bit of progress towards a really important goal. And then you have to think through what it means for a goal to be really important, because that's not obvious. Now, you could say, you're in this class and you're listening to some information, and maybe there's two reasons for that. You might find the information interesting per se, but let's forget about that for a minute. You need to listen to the information so that you can do well on the assignment, so that you can do well in the class. You need to do well in your classes so that you can finish up your degree. You need to finish up your degree so that you can find your place in the world. You need to do that so that you're financially stable and maybe you can start a family and have a life, and that's all part of being a good person, something like that. And so that's a hierarchy of goals. And you might say that being a good person would be the thing, however vaguely thought through, that's at the top of that hierarchy. And then when you're doing things that serve that ultimate purpose, then you're going to find those more meaningful. And that meaning is actually produced as a consequence of the engagement of this exploratory circuit that's nested right down in your hypothalamus. It's really, really old. It's as old as thirst and it's as old as hunger. It's really an old system. And so you want to have that thing activated. It might be that the sense of meaning that life can provide to you is proportionate to the amount of responsibility you decide to take on. And that'd be very strange if it was the case, you know, because responsibility, of course, is a kind of weight, obviously, and it's difficult to take on responsibility. But if any positive emotion that you feel, and your control of anxiety, and the control over pain, is dependent on the activation of these systems that watch you move towards a desired goal, then the more complete and weighty the goal is, the more kick there's going to be in the observation that you're moving towards it. And you kind of already know this because you'll have observed in your own life that when you're engaged in something that you believe in, that the time passes properly. You know, you can see this even if you're reading a paper and it's actually related in some intelligible manner to something that you want to learn. So even though it's difficult, you get engaged in it, you can remember it better, you can process it better, and you're not so likely to fall asleep, and you're not so likely to want to find distractions, all of that, you can get into it. And it would be very interesting if that was proportionate to the degree of responsibility that you're willing to shoulder, and I think you can make a strong case for that. I've also often wondered, imagine you could offer people a choice. Here's the choice. You could say, well, your life isn't meaningful. The nihilists have got it right. There's no meaning in your life. And because of that, there's no reason for you to accept any responsibility. So you can live a responsibility-free life, and maybe one of impulsive pleasure-seeking, but a responsibility-free life. But the price you pay is that it doesn't get to be meaningful. Or you could say to someone, no, we're going to do the opposite. We're going to say, you can live a meaningful life, but it's only going to be as meaningful as the amount of responsibility that you're willing to bear. And then you might say, well, what would people choose? Because everybody also always makes noises about wanting to have a meaningful life. But if the price you pay for that is the adoption of responsibility, then it's not so obvious that people would choose meaning over, you know, over pointless pursuits, if the benefit they got for choosing the pointless pursuits was that they really didn't have to care about anything they ever did, right? It's no responsibility. When you go from a bad place to a better place, you go to a worse place first. It's a great thing to know because it also tells you why you might be unwilling to take the next step. You know, you're aiming up, but in order to aim up, you have to let go of something you already have. And then that'll put you into a state of chaos. And unless you're willing to undergo that intermediary state of chaos, and you might not recover from it, you're not going to get to the next level. Many of you, I presume, have seen Breaking Bad. You have this ordinary high school teacher who really thinks that he's an axe, and his family as well. You know, like your typical persona, roughly speaking. He's just a normal guy. But part of the reason that he's a normal guy is because he actually hasn't been put in abnormal circumstances, and then all of a sudden he is. And he has a genuine moral conundrum, right? He's going to die of lung cancer, and he has a son who's got a lot of health problems, and he's terrified that he's going to leave his wife and his child behind with nothing. And so he decides to do something that temporarily that he regards as what they would normally regard as reprehensible. And of course, he just gets tangled up in that. But then as the story unfolds, you see that it's more complicated because it's not that he was just innocent, good guy and he decided to turn bad. He's also very resentful and angry. And it's partly because he's a bit of a pushover at the beginning, or maybe more than a bit of a pushover. And also that he didn't really fulfill his own potential, and that, you know, he had friends who walked down the entrepreneurial path, and maybe they weren't quite fair to him, but whatever. He ends up not very successful as a high school teacher, and so he's really angry about that. And so there's more motivation for him opening up the door to the terrible elements of his personality than just the fact that he's got good motivations to do so, and that unfolds, you know. And so you see the warps and twists in his resentful character increasingly manifest themselves as he walks down this road to really total brutality. So it's one step at a time. And that's the thing, is that you end up in very bad places one step at a time, so you've got to watch those steps. Sometimes you take a leap forward and you learn some things, but you can't catalyze a new identity, so you try to go back and hide in your old identity. And that actually doesn't work, because while things have changed and you've learned something, and that isn't who you are anymore. And so it's like you have to cut parts of yourself off in a destructive manner to fit back into the person that you were. One of the times in your life when you actually realize that you're an individual is when you'll go and ask your parents something and you'll realize they actually don't know any more about what you should do than you do. And that sucks. And that's partly why people are often willing to maintain a tyrant-slave relationship with their father. It's like, on the one hand, you have to be inferior in a relationship like that. You know, you've always got the judge watching you. But on the other hand, there's always someone who knows what to do. There's always someone standing between you and the unknown that you can go ask, what should I do? Well, at some point, you'll realize that the reason you can't ask that anymore is because they actually don't know any more than you do. And then that's a pain, like that is a symbolic death. And that's also when you establish a more individual relationship with your parents. It's at that point that you could conceivably start taking care of them instead of the reverse. And that's a time that should come. But you have to let that image of perfection go, and that exposes you. The conditions of human life are such that suffering is an integral part of existence. Life is suffering. Why? Well, one reason is because of society's arbitrary judgment. Every single one of us has traits and features and quirks and idiosyncrasies that are far from ideal and that are judged by the standards of society as insufficient. And so you suffer because of your imperfect insufficiency in the eyes of others. And you can certainly make the claim that fairly frequently that's arbitrary. And so that's the claim, that society is tyrannical and judgmental and needs to be constantly reconstituted so that the tyrannical element doesn't take full control. And fair enough, you have to stay awake so that that doesn't happen. But the thing is, it doesn't matter what society it is, although they vary in the degree of their tyranny. The mere fact that you're grouped together with other people and have to come up with a common value structure in order to live together means that many of the things that characterize you are going to be suboptimal. And so the price you pay for social being is that much of you is deemed insufficient. Now, hopefully there are various ways that you can be within a society that's sufficiently diverse so that you can find a place where what's good about you in the eyes of others and perhaps in your own eyes can flourish of its own accord, because you don't have to be good at everything. If you can be good at one thing well enough, that might allow you your niche. And hopefully a healthy society allows for that. Certainly societies can become so tyrannical that they don't. The other element of it, clearly, is the mere fact of the arbitrariness of the natural world. You have a lifespan that's going to be counted in the number of decades that you can count on two hands. And that has nothing to do, technically, with the tyranny of the social structure. Now, you could say, if we got our act together more completely, perhaps you could live longer, and fair enough. But the fact of the limits of your lifespan and the suffering that's necessarily a consequence of that, the death of your parents and the death of most people that you will know before you, means that that part of suffering is an integral part of existence itself. And so that can't be laid at the feet of an insufficient social structure, except insofar as it's tyrannical and blind. It's a condition of existence. And then by the same token, you have your own responsibility for some of your unnecessary suffering, because there's things you could be doing to make your life better and to make life better for other people that you know perfectly well that you're not doing. So there's three reasons why you suffer, and one is, well, look at you and the way you're built. It's inevitable. There's not very much of you, and there's a lot of everything else. And so You just don't last that long, and you're fragile across multiple domains, and then you're harshly treated by society, and there's no doubt about that. And then there's responsibility that can be laid at your own feet. The proper pathway through that is to adopt the mode of authentic being. And that is something like refusing to participate in the lie, in deception and the lie, to orient your speech as much as you can towards the truth, and to take responsibility for your own life and perhaps also for the lives of other people. And there's something about that that's meaningful and responsible and noble, but also serves to mitigate the very suffering that produces, say, the nihilism or the flee into the arms of totalitarians to begin with. You need something to shelter you against your own vulnerability. And you can adopt a comprehensive description of reality that's formulated for you by someone else that neatly divides the world into those who are innocent and perhaps innocent victims, and those who are guilty and perhaps the perpetrators of the suffering. But none of that has anything to do with you. And in addition, it's not a reasonable way of assessing the world. The suffering is built in. The existentialist take is, no, that's just how it is. That's just how it is. You don't have to necessarily have done anything wrong for things to get completely out of control. It's a terrifying doctrine, but it's not a hopeless doctrine, because it still says that there's a way forward, there's a pathway forward, and the pathway forward is to adopt a mode of being that has some nobility, so that you can tolerate yourself and perhaps even have some respect for yourself as someone who's capable of standing up in the face of that terrible vulnerability and suffering, and that the pathway forward, as far as the existentialists are concerned, is by, well, certainly by the avoidance of deceit, particularly in language, but also by the adoption of responsibility for the conditions of existence and some attempt on your part to actually rectify them. And the thing that's so interesting about that is, well, two, as far as I'm concerned, and some of this is from clinical experience, you know, if you take people and you expose them voluntarily to things that they are avoiding and are afraid of, you know, that they know they need to overcome in order to meet their goals, their self-defined goals. If you can teach people to stand up in the face of the things they're afraid of, they get stronger. And you don't know what the upper limits to that are, because you might ask yourself, like, if for 10 years, if you didn't avoid doing what you knew you needed to do, by your own definitions, right, within the value structure that you've created to the degree that you've done that, what would you be like? Well, you know, there are remarkable people who come into the world from time to time, and there are people who do find out over decades-long periods what they could be like if they were who they were, if they spoke their being forward. And they get stronger and stronger and stronger, and we don't know the limits to that. We do not know the limits to that. And so you could say, well, in part, perhaps the reason that you're suffering unbearably can be left at your feet, because you're not everything you could be, and you know it. And of course, that's a terrible thing to admit, and it's a terrible thing to consider, but there's real promise in it, right? Because it means that perhaps there's another way that you could look at the world, another way that you could act in the world, so what it would reflect back to you would be much better than what it reflects back to you now. And then the second part of that is, well, imagine that many people did that, because we've done a lot as human beings. We've done a lot of remarkable things. I often ask undergraduates how many hours a day you waste, or how many hours a week you waste. And the classic answer is something like 4 to 6 hours a day. You know, inefficient studying, watching things on YouTube that not only do you not want to watch, that you don't even care about, that make you feel horrible about watching after you're done. That's probably 4 hours right there. No, you think, well, that's 20, 25 hours a week. It's 100 hours a month. That's 2.5 full work weeks. It's half a year of work weeks per year. And if your time is worth $20 an hour, which is a radical underestimate, it's probably more like 50 if you think about it in terms of deferred wages. If you're wasting 20 hours a week, you're wasting $50,000 a year. And you are doing that right now. And it's because you're young, wasting $50,000 a year is a way bigger catastrophe than it would be for me to waste it, because I'm not going to last nearly as long. And so if your life isn't everything it could be, you could ask yourself, well, what would happen if you just stopped wasting the opportunities that are in front of you?